15th of May, the year 2002. Tonight is already the fifth day of Sivan, Erev Shavuos, and in the year Tovshin Samach Beis. And it's wonderful to prepare for the giving of the Torah by studying a little bit Torah tonight. What we did last week, of course, we went over various things in connection with the general theme of this particular chapter, which starts off by saying that if you read it in the wrong order, then in that particular case have not fulfilled your obligation of reading the Megillah. And then afterwards we have, for example, the following question: what if a person slumbers during the time of the reading the Megillah? So the halacha, I have to tell you, is as follows. Okay, if you are reading it yourself from a Megillah, from a regular scroll, then in that case you would be yotzei. Okay? But if, let's say, you're half asleep listening to the reading of the Megillah, it means that you have lost some of the words over there, so you have not really fulfilled the obligation of hearing the entire Megillah. So that's already a different story.
Yourself.
Huh? Well, gee, I know when I'm tired and I started to read, you know, in my eyes. So I have to struggle every Friday night. Not want to go over the center. It's a battle. I have to battle to keep my eyes open.
Point eight. Point one.
So it could certainly happen. Okay. And then after that,
person says, "I don't hear myself."
Right. All right. So the next thing that we're talking about right now is where we start tonight. Okay.
Yeah.
And you see where the first big line is on the page?
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Go up three lines over there. Okay. No.
Where?
Hoya Kosbro.
Okay.
See how it goes well?
Right. One, two,
right. Okay. Now, the Mishnah continued, and this is the quotation from the Mishnah, and it said, Hoya Kosma, a person was writing a Megillah, Doshor, or else, let's say, he was giving a lesson, and using, of course, what? The text of the Megillah in front of him, right? Umagiha, Magiha in Hebrew, is somebody who studies the text in order, not for learning, but in order to make sure that all the letters are there, are written perfectly, okay? And see that there are no mistakes in it, okay? So, if you engage in any of these three activities, I said any of them, right? So, in Kivein Ribo Yetzon, then in that particular case, if he had in mind to fulfill the mitzvah of reading the Megillah, then he has fulfilled his obligation doing so. But if he was only doing it without the intention of fulfilling the Megillah, then in that particular case he has not fulfilled the obligation of the reading of the Megillah. Okay? Is that clear?
Because
we're talking about Kavanah. If he's writing, right?
Well,
so
would he be writing the Megillah the same day that you have to read the Megillah?
Well, obviously, it would only apply to someone who was actually writing it, let's say, either the night of the 14th or the day of the 14th,
you know,
okay?
The last few words.
Yeah, not just the last three words, but we have to assume that he was writing, I don't know whether he was writing a complete text or maybe he had to complete a text. You're right, I mean, it's possible, whatever it may be, but that wouldn't make sense. Simply why? Because of the fact that you do not fulfill the obligation, as we'll see, unless you read a prescribed section of the Megillah. Now, what are those prescribed sections? We'll see in a few moments that there is a difference of opinion as to where you do it and so on.
Mm.
If we ever get to that thing.
What
it describes, yes,
has the intent.
Yeah.
I will write the first section or the first page,
yeah,
the rest I will continue reading.
Well, if he's gone through a complete text, after all, I mean, in order to do so, we have to assume, you know, that every letter, every word, you know, was correct, you know, that he was writing, okay? So in that case, I guess it would be, and then that maybe would be like in the category that we had in the Mishnah, if he read it b'seirugin, if you remember, meaning, you know, a little at a time, and then continue from where he'd left off before. So I think that that probably would be in a similar category.
And that would be okay?
Then that would qualify as you're able, that you have fulfilled your obligation. Because he read it, he read it from, first of all, he did as much as he did in the text itself, a Megillah text, right?
Oh, okay.
And then he continued in another text of the Megillah, from where he'd left off. And in that case, it would mean, you know, that he'd done the complete Megillah.
Wouldn't it have to be in the same day?
Sure.
It has to be in that same day.
Yeah, so right.
He started to write, say, and then he's gotten halfway through.
Yeah.
And then read the rest?
Read the rest from another Megillah.
From another Megillah.
That's correct, yeah. In that case, it would be like the same again, okay?
One question. What if a scribe, who knows, let's assume that he knows the Megillah by heart.
Right.
He starts reading and finds that the scroll is puzzle, and he in his mind knows that and continues reading the right way.
That is already a problem. It's a problem. However, it could be either a machmir or a mekel in the particular case. If you're a machmir, you say every letter must be perfect, right? But if you remember, we did learn last week that if the letters were metush toshos, okay, blurred, and we said if you could at least figure out what the letter is supposed to be, then you would be yetzer with it, okay? If the letter completely left out, that's already a different problem. But if the letter was there, but it was blurred or something like that, and, you know, you can at least make out the fact that, let's say, it was supposed to be a gimel, or it was supposed to be a nun or a chof or whatever it may be, then in that case, you would be yetzer. Unless, as we learned last week, if the entire text was so blurred, so in that case, then you say that megillah is invalid. Okay?
What
we learned last
week. A broken letter,
yeah.
A broken letter makes it possible.
You'd have to figure it. If you could still recognize the fact what the letter is, right? So that in that particular case, it's more lenient than in the reading of the Sefer Torah, right?
If he finds that the Megillah is puzzle, as Rick says, okay,
right?
Does he have to go back and start all over again with a kosher Megillah?
No.
He can fix it, right?
No.
He can take that.
No,
if
he doesn't have the ink or, you know, a pendant or an ink ready, you know, then he can fix it. How is he going to fix it? Unless he has this material there. But nevertheless, we would be inclined to a leniency in such a case. Because, particularly if you have an olam over there, you know, you also have to take into account the tircha de tzibur, you know, in order not to create additional burdens for the congregation. And as I said, we're a little bit more lenient in the case of the reading of the Megillah as compared to the reading of the Torah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alright.
Okay. So, alright, so that's the person who is writing it, or let's say our Rebbe is giving a lecture on it. He has the complete text, and he goes through the entire text of the Megillah. That's the point. He has a Megillah in front of him, and he reads every single word of the Megillah, and, you know, and he explains as he goes along, or whatever it is, or he's making a comment upon it, or something like that. Then in that case, it would be kosher. I mean, we have the problem. You have an Olam who comes into shul, right? And they don't, for example, understand the words.
Right.
Okay, good. So we give them a text with an English translation. But still, let's say maybe the rabbi wants to say a couple of words in between just to give a general idea of what is the action that's going to take place in the next part and so on. Okay? So if we had something like that, as long as we do the entire text, right? So in that particular case, then we would be AC, even though there is that interruption in between. But then again, that goes into the category of the same woman, okay? With interruption, but still you do it, okay? All right? And then, of course, the other one, the Magiha, obviously he has a complete text on the Megillah in front of him, but he wants to make sure that every letter is perfect over there. If he has to correct something, he'll correct something as he goes along. So, you know, after all, Purim is not on a Shabbos, it's on a weekday. so that he has the opportunity to correct if he wants. So if he goes through the entire text from beginning to end, and this is what he had in mind, then in that particular case he would be easy. Okay? Needless to say, he would be an individual. I mean, you can't do that for the Elam. You understand? You cannot. Right. But he's only doing it as an individual person. You can't start in to look at a text and see whether it's correct and so on while people are waiting, you know, to hear the reading of the Megillah. So as an individual, you can do it. The same thing with the person who is writing the Megillah, obviously. You're right. See, you're an individual who's writing the Torah, the Megillah. Okay. So, the Gemara asked the following question. It says, Hey Chidani, give me an example. How does it work out? He says, Either Korban Sadeh Pesukah Pesukah V'chosav Lo. So, in Kivan Ibei, my Hava. So he says, if, for example, he had in mind, and he writes a Pesuk, and then he writes another Pesuk, right? He has a mind right now, as we said. Why even he writes it down. And then, etc., you know, and it takes the next part second and does it and so on. So,
is he writing or is he reading?
First he's thinking it, and then he writes it down. So the Gemara says, even if he had the intention of fulfilling the reading of the Megillah, my Hava, what's this? Alpehu. What he's doing is actually he's trying to do the Megillah by heart, right? And that you can't do. You have to do what? You have to read the Megillah from a text. He has to read the Megillah from a text. So in that case, that's not what we mean. Error, but rather what we're talking about is the course of Suka Basuka accordingly. We assume that first he writes the sentence, right? And he writes another sentence and so on, and then he reads it actually from what he has written. But the question is, Umi Otsa, and you mean to say that this is also you're enabling to fulfill the mitzvah? Omer Rabbi Chelbo, didn't Rabbi Chelbo say as follows? Omer Rav Chomo Bar Gurya, he said in the name of Rav Chomo Bar Gurya, Omer Rav, he said in the name of Rav, he says, Halacha kedivehu omer kula. He says, the halacha follows the opinion that says you have to read the entire Megillah. Okay? So in that particular case, to simply write a sentence and then read it, you're still not fulfilling it. Why? Because you don't have a complete text of the Megillah. And even in accordance with the opinion, and this we'll have a little bit later, where it says, Be'ishuhuri, in other words, there is an opinion that says that the obligation to read the Megillah is not from the very beginning, as Rabbi Meir is, we'll see, this is his opinion, but you can start after the beginning of the second chapter where it's written about Mordechai, Yishuhudi Hoya Bishushan Amira, we write there was a Jewish man who lived in Shushan, the capital, and so on, Shmai Mordechai, and his name is Mordechai, and they give his genealogy, and so on and so forth, right? So, even in such a case, Sericha Shadeik Suva Kula, even in such a case where this opinion says that you could read the beginning from Ish Yehudi rather than by Eber Be'achashverosh, but nevertheless, what kind of a text do you have to have it? You have to have a complete text in front of you. Even if you're reading in the bridge version, in other words, you still have to have a complete text in front of you. So, error, so we have to assume that this is the situation. The Mamcha Megillah Kameh, there is a Kosher Megillah that's lying in front of him, the calling law, right, and he reads from it, right, psuka psuka, sentence by sentence, the chosav law, and then he writes down the sentence as he reads it. All right, so in other words, he has fulfilled the idea that he has a complete text of the Megillah in front of him, right, and the fact that he's reading it, so, and he writes it, okay, but, you know, sentence by sentence, but at least if he manages to go through the entire thing, the entire text of the Megillah, then in that case it would be Yotzei. Leima Messiah Rei, the Rabbi Baruch Hu, shall we say that this opinion represents support for the opinion of Rabbi Bar Bar Chona. The Omar, in as much as Rabbi Bar Chona said, right, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, the name of Rabbi Yochanan, he said, also lichtev os achas shalom inachzav. He says that it is prohibited to write even one letter if you're not using it, if you're not writing it from an actual written text. Now, if this applies to the Megillah, and incidentally this is halacha, all the more so it applies to what? Writing the Sefer Torah. When you have a Sofer who writes a Sefer Torah, he actually has to have a copy of a Sefer Torah in front of him in order to make sure that he's writing it correctly. Okay? This is the reason why almost, you know, if you take a look at the text of the Sefer Torah, you have the impression that one model seems to be the general model for most of the Sefer Torah. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way, by the way. But it serves that way. I mean, when I say it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, that they all come out looking exactly alike, because they don't. First of all, in older days, they didn't necessarily, you know, don't forget, everything is done by a scribe, okay? It's not a machine. It's not a photograph. It's an individual scribe. And each scribe has his own way of writing the letters.
Was Rabbi Meir, was he allowed to do it because he was so...
Yeah, we're coming to him, right.
He knew the whole
Yeah,
way.
Yes, right, okay, right. Yes.
The Torah scroll, each section.
Yeah.
The column, right?
Right.
Are they identical in the content?
Most of the Torah scrolls look alike. They're not required to, but it became the style. We call it Vavei Ramudim because almost every column begins with a Vav. Say almost every, not every, but most of them begin with a Vav. So it's called Vavei Ramudim, and therefore you see, like for example, you know, they have a tikkun. Some of the tikkuns are printed so it looks like a text of a Sefer Torah, okay? If you know that well, you'll see that you won't have too much trouble reading from the Sefer Torah, because most of the Sefer Torahs have exactly the same format, so to speak, okay? But it's not necessarily so, because I've seen other Sefer Torah. Many, many years ago, I used to work in the manuscript room at the Jewish Theological Seminary Library, and over there I had occasion to see all kinds of Sefer Torah over there, and you know, not every scribe followed the Vavei Ramudim pattern. Prior to that, you know, each one had, the only thing that you had to have, however, was the fact, you know, that where we have space in the middle, what is indicated by a sabach, that's observed. You have a space at the end of a line, right? So that's what we call psuchi, you know, there's a letter pay over there and so on. So that, of course, that has to be observed. And then we have by tradition certain columns that have to begin with a certain mnemonic device. It's biyor shmo. In other words, what is the base? Bereshis. Okay? And then when you come to the Vayechi, you come Yehuda ato yoducha achecha. Okay, so then that's the beginning of that column over there. Okay, and a few others, I mean, like that. Okay, so if you know them, you know. So there, a scribe has to be careful to follow that tradition. Okay.
But the training, yeah. That's where the training comes in. I mean, that's where the training comes in.
Yeah.
They're trained
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah, this requires...
It's not
right. Either you learn by being apprenticed to a sefer, right? Yeah. Or today, some of the yeshivas are giving what they call safras courses. Safras meaning, in this particular case... Right, how to be a sefer, okay? And don't forget, of course, a sefer has to write not only a Sefer Torah, not only a Megillah, but he has to know also how to write tefillin, mezuzahs, right? And the ksuba, that's not necessary, no. But a get is absolutely necessary. A get must be written also by a Sefer, right? So at least you have to know that. And I'll tell you, there are also scrolls, Megillahs, which contain the individual books. We still have over here one or two. Once upon a time, I'm sure, you know, maybe 70 years ago, we had a complete set. Today, we hardly have anything. But, for example, I think we have a copy of Roots. I think we have a copy of Kahelet, if I'm not mistaken, or something like that. An individual scroll, which is written. And then if you go to the older shuls, either in America or in Israel, and particularly this is true also many of the yeshivas, you'll find that they have a scroll, for example, Yeshaya, so that you can read that. You know, if you have a Haftorah, they actually read a Haftorah from a scroll. Right.
The so, had a lot of scrolls.
Yeah.
Sent last year, but deep repair.
Is that so? Were they ever repaired? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Haftorah scrolls. That's what I'm talking about. Right. Yeah. So that in such a case, you really need a Balkriya to memorize the text in the Haftorah in order to be able to read it. And so the person who's called up normally just says the bracha before and then the bracha's after. That's it.
What is
yeah.
the Balkriya when they break up the aliyahs?
Yeah.
Where they stop.
Okay. We already know by tradition, I mean, this goes back for a long, long time, you know, that you read up the Sheni, this is where Sheni is, this is where Shlishi is, this is where Nii is, and so on.
You see around Achron?
But that's a very different story. You know, for Achron or Ahosefa or something like that, you have to go according to the following. First of all, you always must make sure that you have at least three psukim before and three psukim after. You must have that. And if, for example, you have, let's say, a
Akron? From Akron?
It makes no difference whether it's Akron or whether it's
beginning to the end.
Or it's, let's say, an additional aliyah, whatever the additional aliyah may be, okay? There must be at least three psukim that you read. You must read that, okay? And you must leave room. Of course, often you finish the seder, but let's say if you make a sefer, an additional aliyah in the middle, you have to make sure there are at least three psukim for the next aliyah. Okay? But it's more complicated than that because you also have to make sure that there are enough verses so that, it does not, for example, run over these breaks of the text, you know, indicated by the Salach or the Pei. If, for example, you would read three psukim, there are only two psukim left before the end of that paragraph, then that's no good. You can't do it. Understand? And then we try as much as possible to conclude a section on a happy note, okay? You don't want to stop in the middle of something bad. Something, okay, you want to stop in the middle. So,
read that up to the Valkyrie.
Yeah, right. I mean, in my case, you know, I always look for the text in advance to see, can we, first of all, do we have room for it? And if so, where would be a good place where to stop? Okay. No. What I said is that there is one opinion that holds that you start from, but that's not our accepted opinion. No, it's not our accepted opinion. I mean, we say that you have to read the entire one, but that one opinion is, we'll see, there are three, four other opinions as well. Okay? Yeah. All right. Okay, so the answer is okay, maybe he just happened to chance upon having a text in the beginning in front of him, so therefore when he was writing he happened to have one in front of him, but if he didn't have one in front of him, then that wouldn't be right. Gufo, getting back again to Omer Rabo Barabachone or Rabbi Yochanan, it says also Nechtov Esacha Shalom in Aksav, that he says that it is prohibited to write even one letter in the Megillah without writing it from a copy of a Megillah, or as I said, a Sefer Torah, right? So in Meisbe, an objection was raised to this idea. What was the objection? Omer Rabbi Shimon Bar Abba, he said, Masa Rabbi Meir, says, why? I know the story about Rabbi Meir, that watch. Sholach la'aber shona be'asya. He could not. You know, it was time to make an ibiyor, as we could say, right, to have, you know, an extra month of Adar. But remember, this was, as we learned in Rosh Hashanah, this was the prerogative of what? Of the Bezdin HaGadol in Eretz Yisrael, okay? But because of Roman persecution, don't forget Rabbi Meir lived at the time when the Romans were persecuting Jews, so he went to a place called Asya. Where it is, I don't know, I don't think that he went over to Asia, unless it means he went to some place in Asia Minor, I don't know. Because I don't know geographically where exactly this Asya is. But at any rate, he went there in order to, you know, to make sure that the new moon had been seen, and also, you know, that the simonim, that the signs, you know, point to the fact that if he did not make an additional month, then Pesach would arrive much too early, would be still in the middle of the winter instead of being in the springtime, the beginning of spring, which Pesach has to be, okay? So, under those circumstances, he went, and you know what? He didn't have a Megillah with him. So what happened? Oh, Hayosha Megillah, right? There was no Megillah over there where he went. So, Uchsava Melibo, so what did he do? So he wrote a Megillah by heart. Ukra, or, and then he read it. Okay? So Rabbi Moore said, Shani Rabbi Meir says, look, this is not a general rule. Rabbi Meir is an exception. Why? Because in him is fulfilled the verse, namely, that the pupils of your eyes see bright ahead of you. In other words, he has really the text of the Megillah completely memorized in his brain. Right? And he could write it. And this is what the implication is. So, that was an exception, but still, all right. He still wrote a Megillah, and then he first read it. Okay. But he did not have what? He didn't have a copy of a Megillah in front of him at the time he wrote it. But he was an exception. Rabbi Bachor said to Rabbi Yirmiyah, he said, Rabbi Yirmiyah Medifter, this is the place where he came from. He says, what is the meaning of this particular verse that we just quoted? So he said to him, this is what we're talking about. What do you mean? To see clearly, he says, in your mind, these are the words of the Torah. Dichsiv behu, because it's written concerning the words of the Torah, it's written, that if you simply glance at it and skip over it, then it's disappeared. So in other words, he had this text so well memorized that he knew it by heart and he could picture it in his own mind. This is the way you have to study the words of Torah, that you can picture the entire thing in your own mind. Okay? But even so, nevertheless, even though this is an exception, the fact that, you know, Rabbi Meir knew it by heart, and it was very clear to him from, well, not just word by word, but also the spelling of each and every word. I have to point out that when we read from the Sefer Torah, for example, and by the way, Rabbi Meir is famous as a scribe of the Torah in general, okay? We learned in Gemara and Rosh Hashanah that he was praised for the fact that he was a great Talmud Chacham, and that he knew how to write the entire Torah, and he was praised as being a person who is performing such a great mitzvah on behalf of the people of Israel by writing a Sefer Torah correctly. What I wanted to point out is this. When you read a Sefer Torah, you really have to know the text very well. Why? Because in the Torah very often, they will leave out a letter that normally we would write. I'm talking, for example, we have in Hebrew suffix endings, okay? Suffix endings. What do I mean by that? For example, a yud at the end of a word implies, for example, me, or something like that, okay? A vav at the end of a word could imply him. Him, his, something like that. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. If you saw simply a hey at the end of the word, it would mean her or it if it's a feminine object or something like that, and so on. Now, how do we differentiate between cha and echa? The verb cha and the verb echa, for example.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
How do we differentiate between them? All right, so the answer is that from the point of view of the language, the verb cha means your, you singular, your heart, right?
Right.
And the verb echa, literally, well, I'm talking about if it was spelled with a yud, then in that case it would mean your hearts. Don't ask me. It's the 22nd of May in the year 2002. We are continuing now in Maseches Megillah, Daf Yud Tes, Hebet Aleph, in other words, 19a. We start with a Mishnah, which seems fairly simple, and yet that creates some problems, which I'll touch upon in a few moments. It says, Ben Ir, Sholach Lechrach, Uven Krach Sholach Leir. All right, first of all, we have to again remember what these two terms mean. We learned in the very first chapter of Megillah that the reading of the Torah depends upon the locality. Okay?
The reading of the Megillah.
The reading of Megillah, what did I say? Reading the Torah?
Oh, yeah.
No, I meant the Megillah, right. It depends upon the locality. Okay? If you were living in a city which had a wall, we learned from the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, in other words, the time when Eretz Yisrael was first conquered by Joshua, and the city has been in existence, has a wall around it, and so on, then in that particular case, you read it even as the people in Shushan, who also were living in a big walled city once upon a time. In other words, read the beginning, we learned on the 15th day of the month of Adar, okay? If you live anywhere else, you have to read it on the 14th day of Adar, okay? So far, so good. And then we learned also in the very first Mishnah of the Megillah that in order to make it easier for people who lived in villages, if they found it difficult, you know, to come into the town in order to sell their wares or something like that, and they couldn't hear it on the 14th, so they were given special permission to read the Megillah on, could be the 13th, could be the 12th, it could be the 11th, okay, of Adar. This is what we learned, okay? So you have three different categories then. The Krach, the walled city, right? The Ir, in other words, any other locality, and then the Kfar, or the village. Okay, depending, so that this is what we have to bear in mind. All right, so the Mishnah now says that if a person is a Ben Ir, in other words, he's a person who lives in a city or town or whatever you want to say, in other words, any place other than in a walled city, okay? And he went to the city which has a wall around it, or vice versa. Someone who lives normally in a walled city, who went to a place which is not a walled city, right? So, and of course we're talking about, and here Purim comes, it's the 14th of Adar, right? So, the question is, Im osid la'zolim komo, korebim komo, if he will be able to come back again to his original place, then in that particular case, he reads it in accordance with what the people are reading. So, in other words, let's say a person lives in the Yerushalayim, okay? Most of Yerushalayim today is considered a walled city, even though the walled area within it, you know, is small, but we also learned in the Gemara, the Gila, you know, that if people can see that, located close enough that they could see, you know, the area of the walled city, then in that case they are included in that. Okay, all right? So, that being the case, if a person, let's say, here is the 14th, right? And he goes in to, let's say, he goes to Tel Aviv, okay? Goes to Tel Aviv, or any place else, okay? And there they're going to read the Megillah on the 14th, right? So if he knows that he's going to come back again to Yerushalayim on the 15th, then in that case he doesn't read it on the 14th, but what does he do? He reads it on the 15th, okay? This is the general idea.
When he's back home.
Right, because he knows he's going to be back home again, okay? Right. But if he stays in Tel Aviv, then in that particular case, he has to observe it on the 14th. He has to listen to the reading of the Megillah on the 14th. This is the idea.
That's interesting. That, I thought this was going to be some kind of a precedent for, like, if you're an Eretz, and you observe 2 days, and an Eretz only 1 day, it works the opposite way.
Okay, you anticipate, you know, what I have in mind when I said, you know, that there were ramifications which are not mentioned in the Mishnah over here, but obviously there were ramifications which apply to a much greater problem. Yeah. All right. Well, first let's take a look at the Mishnah, and then we'll get back to that problem. Okay. So we're saying then that if he will return to the place where he is, then in that particular case, he reads it with those people. But if he does not return, he cannot return, whatever it may be, then in that case he has to read the Megillah wherever, in the locality where he is, in accordance to the rule. So in other words, it stands to reason then that if somebody who normally would observe it on the 14th comes to Yerushalayim and he's there, so in that particular case, when should he hear officially the reading of the Megillah? You should hear it on the 15th, you understand? No, that's just the reverse, in other words, of the other way around. Okay? So far, so good. All right. But then the Mishnah continues with a different question. Question is, how much of the Megillah do you have to read in order to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of the reading of the Megillah? Okay? So concerning this, the Mishnah mentions three different points of view. And when we start learning the Gemara, we'll discover that actually there is also a fourth point of view. Okay? What are the three that the Mishnah mentions? So it says, Rabbi Meir, Omer, Kumar. Rabbi Meir says you have to read the entire Megillah, beginning from Vayehi B'nei Achashverosh right to the very end of the Megillah. All right, that's his opinion. Rabbi Yehuda has a somewhat different opinion. He says that we begin the reading of the Megillah, that you're obligated to begin the reading of the Megillah from Yeshuhinu Hayom Shushanabiru, which is shortly after we begin the second chapter, and there it speaks about Mordechai. Okay? Third opinion, that of Rabbi Yosef. Rabbi Yosef Omer, Me'achad Vemeela. This is the beginning of the third chapter in Megillah, where it speaks about after these things, you know, King Achashverosh made Haman great, right? And so that's where the Torah began for the people of Israel. Okay? So we see here three different opinions, and as I say, when we go over the Gemara, we'll discover there's a fourth opinion given as well. Okay?
The second one
is to start from almost the beginning of the second chapter, starting with the mention of Mordechai, the first mention of Mordechai. Okay, Yeshuhudi, there was a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital. His name was Mordechai ben Yoyar ben Shimi ben Kish. All right. So this is what the Mishnah says. Now, as Sylvia has already anticipated, the problem that we have over here really is a wider problem. And it's a problem of people who observe 1 day Yontif because they are Eretz Yisrael people, or people of Chutz La'aretz who observe 2 days Yontif. Okay? What do you do when you're not in your own place, but you're in the other place? You understand? In other words, an Israeli who comes to this country, for example, or if we should happen to be in Israel during the time, you know, that you have a Yontif, which we observe for 2 days, and in Eretz Yisrael they only observe for 1 day. I mean, for example, you know, the problem that I faced when I was there for Pesach. They observed the first day and the seventh day, and I had to observe the first day, the second day, the seventh day, and the eighth day is Yontif, okay?
Oh, you still have to?
Yeah.
You're required? I mean, if you're...
That's a good question.
Because that really shouldn't be.
That's a good question. So, you know, as I say, it's a two-way question. The question is about Israelis who are here. What do they do? And I'll tell you the truth, they are divided in their own opinion as to what to do. Okay? What is the division? Some say that they intend to return to Israel, and therefore they should only observe the holidays in accordance with the Israel schedule. Which is fine, except the question is, but what if it drags on and on and on and on? I mean, if they were to go back immediately, you understand that there wouldn't be any question. The question is only if they stay more than 30 days, and if it stretches into 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and so on. How long can you continue to pretend that you're going back to Eretz Israel? This is what the question is. You understand? So, what they should really do is, if, as long as they're going to be here, you know, beyond a month or anything like that, they should do what everybody is doing. And then, of course, there's still another question. I mean, even if they're going back to Eretz Israel, and for them, you know, they can do whatever they want. I'm talking about now people who are only very short term, okay? But the question is, what about their conduct in public as compared in private? You understand? This is a problem. In other words, in private, they could put on the radio and stuff like that, okay? Put on lights, put on the radio and stuff, you know, that we don't do. Because that's if they're in private. But in public, they shouldn't go riding to shul. We had a couple, I remember when we first came into Springfield, there was a couple from Israel. They were Israelis. They were studying here at one of the colleges, I forget which one. I think at AIC, if I'm not mistaken. And they expected to go back to Israel, which they did, eventually. But, nevertheless, I mean, while they're here, to go to the movies at the X on Yom Tov is not exactly the best behavior, you see.
You mean the second day?
Yeah, on the second day Yom Tov. I'm not saying they did on the first day Yom Tov. Yeah. I'm saying, but on the second day Yom Tov, which to them was Cholamoed or whatever it may be. Right, exactly. Right, smart aside, exactly. Right, yeah. So that's a problem. On the other hand, what is the problem that we had when we went to Eretz Israel?
What
do
the people say?
Yeah. No, not going to say, but they think, you know, that we're being... tough luck, you know, for us.
Yeah.
Tough luck that we have to observe 2 days where they only have to observe one day, okay?
Well, I would ask you this.
Yes.
If you're observing 2 days and everyone else is 1 day, you don't have a regular service in the synagogue.
That's a very good question. All right. If you're with an Eretz Israel minion, obviously you're not going to have it, okay? However, there were enough people in the neighborhood who had come to visit, children, parents, whatever it may be, and so on, you understand?
Yeah.
So that, as a result, we were able to have our own little minion on the second day Yom Tov, and also on the eighth day of Yom Tov. But that's because we had enough people. Otherwise, we would have been out of luck. We would have to daven privately for ourselves and Fatik and so on. So we tried to make a minyan. Baruch Hashem, we had enough for one. Okay, but that depends where. I know that Rabbi Weisfogel told me many years ago we went to visit Rhoda in Efrat. I think it was Sukkot or whatever it was. At any rate, there was no minyan over there for him. So he decided from that point on he's not going to be in Efrat for Yom Tov. In Yerushalayim he could find already places, but in Efrat, no. So, now, what does that to do? You understand? Everybody is doing their daily activity, and and there you are again. It's a very anomalous situation. Right. Let's put it that way.
And there is no definitive ruling as far as
I'll tell you. There are. There's another opinion that says if you're in Eretz Israel, do what they do in Eretz Israel. Right? There are some who hold from that.
If you're in Rome, do with the Romans.
Yeah, in that respect. In other words, there are those who say if you're in Eretz Israel, then observe only one day Yom Tov or something like that. Observe only one Seder or something like that instead of Tuzdar. I observed, of course, Tuzdar. Right. Oh, I ended up there. Okay. So, Mayor, I got a letter from you today. I'm going to need a perish, perish, washing, perish, tasteless, whatever it may be. Go over it afterwards, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Some of these terms I don't understand. Just as I have to know what these terms mean over here, I have to know what the terms of the letter mean too, okay?
It's not a problem. I'd be very happy.
Okay, very good.
That's my ability.
Yeah, okay. All right, so that is the problem then that it's the problem that the Mishnah then has raised, okay? All right, we continue now with the Gemara. We're on your test, on it off. Okay. So, Omer Rava. So now Rava tries to explain what's going on. What is the situation in the observance of the Mishnah? It says, Lo shonu ele sho'osad la'ser, b'lei le yud-dalad, avolein esu lach'ser, b'lei le yaber esu, koru mohe. In other words, what he's saying is that if the person who finds himself, let's say, in a walled city, and he himself comes from an unwalled city, right? So if his intention is to come back, Taka, on the 14th at night, in other words, that's the place, that's when the people of his own native place are reading, right? Then in that case, Kari Mohim, then he has to read, you know, with them. But if he knows he's not going to go back on the 14th, then in that particular case, what does he have to do? Then Kari Mohim means that he has to read the Megillah with the people in the walled city. This is what it means, which would be on the 15th in that particular case. Okay? All right, so far so good. Omer Rava, and then Rava continues, and he says, Minra, how do I know, where do I find a reference in the Megillah itself that this is the proper conduct, okay? So he says, we have a pasuk. What does the pasuk say? It says, Al-Kain ha-Yehudim ha-Prozim ha-Yoshbi ha-Prozos, which means literally, therefore, the Jews who lived in unwalled cities, the Jews of the unwalled cities, who live in unwalled cities. In other words, you notice that what is there? There's like a repetition of the idea. In one case it says, they are Yehudim Prozim, and then the next word says, who live in, or who are staying in, where? In unwalled cities. Okay. Probably the pshat is what? Pshat, in other words, the plain ordinary meaning is that he's defining, you know, what do we mean by prozim? Who are prozim? Prozim are people who live in oral prozims, okay?
In what?
In unwalled cities. So people live in unwalled cities, okay. But when it comes to Midrash, you look always for something, you know, that's unusual in the wording to see if you can derive a teaching from it, okay? So how do Rav interpret this? He says, Michli says, look, Ksiv ha-Yehudim ha-Prozim, right? It's written, the Jews who are Prozim, right? So, Lomelu ha-Mirkos, and why does it then have to write ha-Yoshu mi-Yoy ha-Prozos, who are living in the unwalled cities? So, Okamashmalim, from this we learn, he says, the Prozim, Ben-Yemo Nikropos, that a person who is living in an unwalled city, even for just one day, is called a porus. In other words, because he is living at this particular moment where? In a world city. So therefore he's a porus, even though he comes from a world city. So, you understand? Yeah.
So that's his obligation then to read on the 14th.
That is correct. So then, Rava continues, he says, Ashkechon, okay, so now we have found a reference, porus, you know, for a person who is in an unwalled city. Now, Bukov Manole, how do we know that similar law would apply to someone, you know, who lives in a walled city? So he says, well, he says, it makes sense. The reason is follows. What? Midipos, then Yomokari, Poros, if a person who happens to be in an unwalled city on that particular day is considered a Paro is a person who is in an unwalled city. So Mukov, then you know Kareem Mukov, then in that particular case, someone who is in a walled city for that particular day should be considered also as a person who is a resident of an unwalled city, of a walled city, okay? Of a walled city.
Rabbi.
Yeah. Yeah. I also answer to Phil. Yeah. I also answer to Phil.
She promoted you. I am so deep into the study now that I'm thinking of you. Maybe I'm anticipating, but what about a man, a person who is a resident of Unwalled City?
Right.
He has read the Megillah on the 14th.
Right.
And from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, it isn't impossible that the next day
He'll be in Jerusalem.
He'll be in Jerusalem.
Very good. You know what you do? You make everybody happy.
You
right.
Read
you read it again.
It's supposed to be you. Twice anyhow. At night
and the well. Well, that is required. But so if you go and do it four times, so there's your fellow. So you can do it. It happens. I'll give you an example. I mean, that I observed with my own eyes, okay? On one of our visits to Eretz Yisrael, it was Purim time. So happens, granddaughter got married shortly before Purim, and so on, so and obviously we're there for Purim, okay? So at that particular time, where they were, yes, we lived, they were living in a place, Ramot, which is Ramot, great big area in Yerushalayim, but it was a new area. And some people, some of the authorities in Ramot, not everybody, this is not universal agreement, even at that time, but there were some who had the idea that inasmuch as he could not see the Har HaBayis, in other words, the Temple Mount, from Ramot, so that therefore it should be considered like
unworld
city, right. Subsequently, they changed their mind, but at least at that particular time, this was their opinion, okay? So what was the result? The result was that we read the Megillah in Ramot with a bracha and some of the night and the day, and then we went into the heart of Yerushalayim itself where they were serving the 15th, and then all over again, that's all. So that's the reality of the situation, okay? All right. Then, another question that Rabbi raised, he says, a person lives in a village. Now remember, the village we learned, that they can read on the 11th, 12th, or 13th of Adar, depending upon, of course, when the Monday or the Thursday was. Okay? Because those are days that we call Yom HaKnisa, when people come into town and so on and so forth. So, Robert said, somebody who lives in a village, She'olach le'ir, and he went to a town, to a city, and in that particular case, Ben Kach, makes no difference, even if he read it in his own place on the 11th or 12th or the 13th, but nevertheless, when he comes to the town on the 14th, then in that particular case, he has to read it together with the people who read it on the 14th. My Talmud, what's the reason? He says, Hai Kivnei Ha'ir. Burn the mikra. So the answer is that Rebbe says, he says, well, the reason is because in reality he should be reading it to begin with on the 14th, even if he was a person living in the village, right? The Rabbonim who the Akira Hakfon, and it was only the rabbis who gave a leniency to the people who lived in the villages, right? That they could do what? That they could read it prior to the 14th. Kedoshi Isapke Maimimus Nachim Shabakrokim. The reason being that this way they would be able to supply water and food to their brethren who live in the cities. Okay? So it's for that reason, you see. So the Gemara then says, Hami Mireke Isa Beduchte. Alright? Okay. Where they gave permission that they could read it on the 13th, 12th, or 11th, that was Ki'isi Beduchte, if he simply stayed in his own place and he never went into the city. You understand? Avo, Ki'isi Be'ir, but if he happens to be in the city on the 14th, then there's no question, Ki'ir Bo'er Le'Mikra. He has to read it the same as the people in the city, namely on the 14th. Okay. So, Abaye, who's always questioning Rava's opinions, okay? Noah's has a different opinion. Occasionally they have the same opinion, okay? They both are in agreement. But very often he questions Rava. So Abai asked the following question. He says, look, Ben Krach Shohel Achle'ir, if a person is one who lives in a walled city, right? And he goes into the unwalled area, right? So Ben Krach Korei Kimikombo. Then it makes no difference that whether he's in a city, you know, an unwalled city or not, but he has to read it in accordance with his own practice. In other words, when should he read the beginning? He should read it on the 15th. This is what Abai is questioning right now, right? And then he says, Ben Krach Sakadatech. You're asking me a question about somebody who lives in the walled city? It has nothing to do with whether he comes from one area or the other area. The important thing is, however, is he going to return to where he expects to be there? This is where what it depends on. So I have a lot, but rather, Ben Kfar, but rather, you know, he becomes like, the question was only about people who lived in the villages, what to do. And of course, as we said, in their particular case, if they're going to be in a town on the 14th, then that's the real time for them to read the Megillah.
So
yes.
They are anticipating the trip, so they will not read it on the 11th, 12th, or 13th at all?
They could read it on the 11th, 12th, or 13th, but they have not fulfilled the obligation by doing so if they're going to be in town on the 14th.
Right.
So then they have to read it with the people. That's
but,
correct.
But
yeah.
If they're in the town, 11, 12, or 13,
yeah,
to be with their own community,
right,
then again, they have to do what the community is doing. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
So
yeah, definitely. Right. Yeah. V'lav teruzo mitatz, but tami koreya mohim. And we're not really arguing the point, but what we have to do is to say that he reads with the people where he is, period. Okay. So that, of course, as we said, by the same token, a person who normally would observe on the 14th, but it happens to be in Yerushalayim on the 15th, then he has to read the beginning at that point. He wants to read it to himself on the 14th, Gesundheit. But he has not fulfilled the obligation unless he does it together with the community in which he resides. Okay. All right. Now, the second question that was raised at the beginning is an easier question to answer. Okay. We stated that the second part of the Mishnah says, how much of the Megillah do you have to read in order to fulfill the obligation? Okay? Where do you start from? So we have three different opinions given, right? Rabbi Meir, who said the entire one, Rabbi Yehuda, who said about Yehudi, and then Rabbi Yossi, who said that it's Achad Rebbe, in other words, beginning of the story of Hobbit. Okay? So, Tanya, we have another teaching. And this is Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. That's what that abbreviation means. Rashbi Shimon ben Yochai. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, he says, Mibalaila Hahu. He says, you know where the obligation of reading the Megillah starts with? It begins with, actually, this would be about the fifth chapter, where it's written, Balaila Hahu, Nedadosh Nas HaMelech, right? That on that particular night, the king was unable to sleep. Okay? And then, of course, what happened after that? First of all, right, the book, right, was open as we learned, we did the first chapter, right, the book, they wanted to close it, but the Malach kept opening the book to the story of Mordechai and so on, right, so that they were forced to read the story about how Mordechai saved the king's life, and then, the king wanted to know what kind of reward to give, and lo and behold, Haman shows up in the court, etc., very dramatic part over there. So, this is where we have to begin reading it. So, the question is, why do we have four now different opinions as to how much is required? Okay? It's a question. So, Rabbi Yochanan said, V'chulun nikra chodoshu. He says, you know what? All of these four opinions are based only upon one verse in the Megillah itself. What is that the verse is written, Vatikhtov Esther HaMalkon, that Queen Esther wrote to Mordechai HaYehudi, and you know, together with Mordechai the Jew, Es Kol Tokef. Tokef means literally force. In other words, they wrote about all the forcefulness, Es Kol Tokef, and everything else that happened and so on. So the question is, what kind of an expression is this? The force, okay? Because today we have another force, right? Darth Vader or whatever it is. It's the invisible force. I can't stand Star Wars. I can't stand it.
We're in the wrong generation.
All right. So anyway, may the force be with you, right? The force. All right, what is the force? So, the question is, whose force? All right, so he says, Mando, Makula, the opinion of the one that says, I have to read the entire Megillah, because that was Rabbi Meir's opinion, right? So he says, talk for Shel Achashverosh. We're talking about the force of Achashverosh. In other words, his might, the fact that he reigned over 127 kingdoms, etc., etc., etc. That's the power of Achashverosh. Omando, Mami Yeshuhudi, and the second opinion, the one that said that you begin reading with the second chapter where it says there was a Jewish man in Shushan Abira, his name was Mordechai, and so on and so forth. So this is called Pusha Mordechai. This shows the power of Mordechai. Okay? Omando, Omar, and the opinion which says Acharad Borim Ha'ele, right? Begin reading at that point, so let's talk with Shalhomer. This is to show, you know, the power of Haman. And how about the last opinion that we read, the Rabbi Shimon Yochai says, Ma'andum in Balala Ha'u. So that's Tokvah Shemes. This shows us the power of the miracle that took place, you know, that all of a sudden all these things fell into place, right? Reading of the book, Esther coming to the queen, to the king, and, you know, asking him to...